Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. And don't forget to retune your radio dials to 101.1 FM, our new frequency on the FM dial. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Zen Master Genpo Roshi about his book and his upcoming workshop called Big Mind, Big Heart. We're also going to be hearing a commentary from Ron Bloomberg because today is Tuesday. Right now, I would like to welcome Jeannie Everett. She's the director of Trauma First Aid Associates, and Pam Burnham, who's a psychotherapist who's been practicing for 30 years. And the two of them will be part of a team that's teaching a course this weekend called Trauma First Aid. Welcome, ladies.
Morning. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
What is trauma first aid? We know what shock and Band-Aid and all these other things are. When let's say you have a trauma, you have a car accident, people will treat you for shock. They'll bandage your wounds. But what's the trauma aspect?
The trauma that we're working with is that aspect that's non-medical that goes along with medical. But it's the shock to the whole mind-body system. The body may be just fine or not, but there's a whole shock in the system on spiritual levels, emotional levels, mental levels, psychic levels.
And so under what circumstances is it administered, and who administers it?
That's part of our workshop. Under what circumstances, there are many, and they don't always have to be big traumas with a capital T. They can be little traumas that people don't perhaps even consider to be a trauma, such as a fight with a next-door neighbor that goes on over a period of time and makes it difficult to live next door to them. And so this workshop that we're going to be doing this weekend is geared to specifically people, at least in this workshop, who are going to be working with people who have been traumatized, EMTs, nurses, paramedics, social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists.
Teachers. Massage therapists.
First responders of all
first
kinds.
First responders of all kinds.
And so your flyer states that the course is based on current research on the impact of trauma on the brain and body, based on new findings in somatic psychology, neurology, and endocrinology. There's a lot of ologies there. Let's talk about some of that research. What actually happens to the brain and to the body when somebody's traumatized?
Well, we're seeing a lot of research about changes in the brain. Based on what happens in stress, just the basic stress level, the part of the nervous system that takes care of the fight-flight response. Heart rate goes up, blood pressure goes up. There are changes in blood to make sure that you don't bleed. Changes in getting muscles ready to fight or do something. There's changes in the eyes, muscle tension, all of that. Over a long period of time, there's actually changes in the brain as well.
If a trauma is ongoing, you mean?
Yeah. Or if the person stays in a highly activated state over a long period of time, it still thinks the trauma is going on.
So let's think of an example of that. Somebody loses. I was just listening to the BBC this morning, and somebody loses their parent to the Khmer Rouge. They're traumatized for life. The memory of that stays with them forever, even though it happened when they were 7 years old. So on some level, they keep reliving that, and all these things happen again, the blood pressure, the heart rate, and so on?
Right. What we know is that the brain doesn't distinguish between what's happening in front of you or thinking about something that's happened. Your body still responds as if it's happening. So you bring a thought to mind. For instance, if you think about a lemon, your mouth may water, salivate, your side of your mouth may tighten up, your throat may close. So the lemon is an image. The body still responds to it.
Right.
So as we have thoughts of our parents or things come up about parents or parenting, or you see a picture or a smell of a parent or whatever reminds you, your body will respond to remembering about that. Thought, image, emotions as well. So so the body goes back into that same response. You were giving an example a while ago about having been confronted in your apartment, and that years later, you think about it and you still get a little scared and your heart still races. That's a perfect example of what happens.
Right, right.
And going back to the example that you gave about a little boy who perhaps watched his parents get killed by the Khmer Rouge, it becomes even more complex because he was a little boy and he was totally helpless to be able to do anything about it. Had he been older, had he been at an age where he might have been able to fight back or feel like he was fighting back, the result of that traumatic event probably could have been processed much more differently.
And so that's a very interesting point. The reactions of the body, the response of the brain are different if you have some power in the situation?
Yes,
absolutely.
Very much so.
Explain that.
The body prepares, the reason the heart rate goes up, the reason the muscle tension increases in the arms and legs, the reason the heart rate goes up, the breath changes, is to get ready to fight or flight. So in your personal example that you were telling us about, you said you felt better even being able to fight somebody and having some resolution that you weren't hurt worse. That energy is discharged. Our whole body prepares us to do something, prepares us to fight, prepares us to flight. If we're not able to do that, the energy gets jammed in the nervous system.
And then it becomes a freeze.
Now, what if you are, a person is in a situation where they are confronted, let's say one of the many women who's been either raped or attempted rape here in the wonderful city of Santa Fe where this is happening, they fight back and they lose. The rapist succeeds. Having fought back versus just having passively accepted it and not fought back, is there still a difference in the nervous system response?
Yes.
Yeah, what we're finding is, and what makes people the most susceptible for developing further problems later, like PTSD or whatever, is if they go into a freeze pattern. So, and actually have that dissociative reaction where they kind of leave their body. So in the ability to fight or to stay with or even struggle in some way discharges a lot of that energy, and it doesn't go into that total helpless, that total like, well, my body didn't try to do anything at all.
Now,
into a full collapse.
So you show up on the scene. Let's talk about a first response situation. There's a fire, or there's somebody who's been assaulted or raped, or one of the many traumas that happens that the police and EMTs and so on have to respond to. Here we are, Jeannie Everett and Pam Burnham show up on the scene as well. What do you do? What's your role?
Our first thing is to make sure that that person knows they're not alone. So we're here, you're okay, everything's going to be all right now. To make
so basically
contact.
Having a hand to hold, so
absolutely.
To speak.
We call it connect and contain. So that person, what happens in trauma is a person really feels alone and really feels out of control. So you help them feel like they're not alone. Then what we try to do is normalize what's going on inside of them. Their heart is racing, they're fearful. Those are things normal. Yes, that's a normal thing. Just letting that happen. They may be trembling or shaking. What we know is that that's how the muscles get released, that energy that the heart and the blood pressure has prepared the body to do.
So you don't try to stop them from trembling and shaking. On the contrary, you hold their hand and allow it.
Normalize it. Make it be okay. Even as a nurse, I tried to stop the shaking because I didn't understand what the body was doing when I was working in nursing rather than being a trauma therapist.
And what do you do after that? What happens next?
What happens next is dependent upon what the situation is. They may go off in the ambulance, but at least they will be more stable and more present. And when you're more stable and more present, you're able to have a very different perspective of what's happening. You're able to have a very different ability to relate to the people that you're going to have to relate to when and if you get to the hospital, if that's the situation. If you're not going to the hospital, if you're going back home because it's something that hasn't been that serious, you're going to have less reactive response after that to whoever happens to be at home with you, to your friend, or even to your pet. You know, you're not going to perhaps have a tendency to be so full of this activation because some of it's been discharged that you're just going to indiscriminately yell and be angry or curl up and isolate and not want to talk to anyone.
Another example, if I could. We did a class for firefighters, in New Orleans last year. And after the class, the firefighters said two things. One, would they wish it had this training before the storm, meaning Katrina. And the other thing was that one of the firefighters told me later that he gained the skills to get somebody back from the edge of a bridge who was thinking about committing suicide and jumping off the bridge. So just being able to settle somebody down, their nervous system, and have him have new skills to watch, how do I know that I'm watching a settling in the nervous system? So that he said he felt like he could, like, help someone back from the edge of the bridge so that they could then
both metaphorically and literally.
Absolutely, absolutely. In this case, it was literally. So that they could then make a different decision. Again, connect with someone and not feeling like they're totally alone in the world.
What you're talking about seems to be something that every empathetic person knows. You know, connecting to somebody when every mother knows this. What's the magic in that? I mean, what are you bringing to it?
What we're bringing to it is the understanding of what's happening in the nervous system. It's absolutely what parents know. We feel that this class is valuable to teachers, parents, coaches, anybody that works with anybody. I mean, there's one woman coming that just is coming for her own understanding to deal with her own life and her child, and is not a therapist of any kind.
One group that you haven't mentioned is police. They need to be trained in this. I have to say, and with great respect to the armed forces of the city of Santa Fe, I had this little incident that happened to me, and the reaction of the police was actually more traumatic for me than the assault incident itself. Because when they came, the policeman didn't believe me, questioned me, told me I was drunk and on drugs and all this thing. And then when they found physical evidence, which there was abundantly, then they came back and they said, oh, something really did happen. To which I responded, I know, that's why I called 911.
That's right.
But it was more traumatic. I ended up wishing I hadn't called the police at all.
We've heard that before. We've also heard from people that they say the most important thing that happened to them, no matter what the situation was the response of the EMTs. That they either made it better or they made it worse, just like you're saying with the police. And so, again, as a nurse, I didn't know this information, and I wish I had. And there's we have several firefighters that have taken the class that now want to teach the class to firefighters. There's two EMTs coming to the class that we're hoping the same thing. So it's a growing understanding of what's happening in the nervous system and not just an emotional, you know, soothing of somebody. It's far deeper than that.
Well, and the other piece that I would like to add is it's not just for firefighters, first responders, police, therapists, and what they can do to help their client or their patients. It's also what they can do to help themselves so that they don't end up with PTSD, because they're exposed to secondary trauma all the time, every single day. And it's a way, it gives them tools to be able to work with the people that they're serving and allow discharge of the secondary trauma, and that it doesn't accumulate and end up in what we know as burnout.
We're talking to Jeannie Everett and Pam Burnham, who are teaching a course this weekend called Trauma First Aid. Go ahead.
I was an ICU nurse, and I think that a lot of what the compassion fatigue and burnout, what's called burnout, is really about the overwhelm of the nervous system. And we talked before, we went to Thailand to help with the tsunami, and then we went in to help Katrina, the survivors of Katrina, 13 times. And just having these skills to take care of us really helped us from, you know, getting burned out and this whole compassion fatigue that we are just beginning to understand.
Now, can the tools that you were teaching in trauma first aid be used for somebody who had the trauma a long time ago?
Yes.
I mean, as you say, the nervous system is reacting the same way, but the patterns have also set in.
They have, and so it makes it a little more complex. It makes it a little harder. It takes a little longer, and yes, it works. These same tools, the same way of helping the nervous system to discharge the energy that's accumulated, it's absolutely possible in my practice, whether it's 3 days or 30 years.
Yeah, because what we keep saying, what we really teach over and over again, it's not in the event, it's in the nervous system. So that something may have happened 5 days ago or 5 years ago, like Pam said, or 50 years ago, if it's still responding in the nervous system as if it's happening now, that's when we know it's trauma.
And people don't understand this, I don't think, Mary Charlotte, because they're not able 10 or 15 or 20 or more years later to make a logical connection between why they're feeling the way they feel or why they're doing what they do, why they're responding in a certain way every time a certain situation comes up.
And some people, of course, don't even have, if it's long enough ago, they don't even remember what the original trauma was. And there's a lot of people who want to uncover buried memories, but the psyche, in its infinite wisdom, sometimes wants to protect you from that because it's more traumatic to remember than not remember.
Always, which is why the traditional way of practicing psychotherapy is to have the client retell their story, their narrative, over and over. And what research has shown is that that is re-traumatizing. So when I started to do this kind of work in 1998, it totally changed my practice.
Very interesting. What did you start to do in 1998?
I started the training with Peter Levine, learning somatic experiencing.
Now, somatic experiencing, the word somatic keeps coming up in this, somatic psychology, neurology, somatic experiencing. What does the word mean? What is this whole somatic thing?
Soma is body. So it's related to the body. So the movement in psychology these days is towards somatic psychology. So again, it's finally bringing the body and the mind back together again.
So when you do this in your practice, in your psychotherapy practice, it's not about telling the story anymore, or it's about telling the story in a new way?
It's both. Because for some people, it's very important to tell the story. And I absolutely respect that. This way allows me to say to someone, how would it be if you just stopped right here and noticed what you're feeling, what you're sensing? And they'll say, well, I'm not breathing very well, or I don't feel like I'm connected any longer. And so we can take some time and we can help someone. I can help someone to feel connected again in their body, and then they can continue with their story.
And like you said, sometimes there is no story. There's just these random feelings, sensations, responses that come, and people don't know where they come from.
And I've often wondered, for people like that who are in that situation where they know something's wrong, but they don't really know what, can they be healed without actually finding the supposed story?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. If it's early trauma, and what we say is, in trauma, the part of the brain, Broca's area, speech, doesn't even light up in trauma. So that part of the brain doesn't even get juice. That's why there's words like scared, speechless. There are no words.
Right.
Especially if it's pre-verbal trauma.
That's right. Now, Trauma First Aid Associates is putting this on. Is this a new group? This is your group, Jeannie
uh-huh.
Everett.
Yep. When we went to Thailand, we were really taxed. We were asked by the Thai Red Cross and a MASH unit that we were traveling with to teach them what we were doing, and we didn't have a teeny short course. I come out of the medical background and had felt a long time that we needed something short and sweet that we could do in the field, in disasters. I think it's really appropriate for the military, and as you said, first responders. So we came back and created this like short course for just this, you know, these short interventions that you may never see anybody again. It's not the same as therapy where you have these long relationships that you develop. In these kind of situations, there's no time to tell the story. You're just dealing with what's at hand. You're helping someone settle. You're watching what's happening in their nervous system and helping them reconnect and recontain themselves. And so there were all, I think there's a total of 12 of us now that went to Thailand or Katrina that all got excited about teaching this in the short course. So there's I think there's a total of 12 of us doing this together. That's the Trauma First Aid Associates.
And I did not go to Thailand with Jeannie on the first trip, but I did go back a year later with Lori Leach, who does research. And what we discovered was that the trauma work that was done the year previously was still, people were still feeling the positive effects. It had not dissipated. It had not gone away.
If people want to sign up, people who are listening, or even just ask more questions about trauma first aid, and you're teaching, I guess, a couple of different levels this weekend at the Santa Fe Rape Crisis Center, they can go to tfaassociates.com, and can they give you a call?
We're also doing a class in October, the end of October. I think it's the 20th and 21st, or 21st, 22nd.
If you can't make it this time. What's the telephone number over there?
585-471-5815.
585.
I'm sorry, 505.
505, thank you.
471-5815.
5815. So 471-5815 is the number. Jeannie Everett and Pam Burnham, thank you so much for talking with us about this amazing subject.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now and hear from Ron Bloomberg as well as some of our beloved underwriters, and then we're going to be talking to Genpo Roshi. Stay tuned to KSFR.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just the voice in the crowd. Between the Democrats and Republicans, there must be 15 candidates running for president. And the one thing they have in common? Most of them are lawyers. Why? Do we hold lawyers up as the most noble of people? Are you kidding? You know, much of comedy is an exaggeration of truth, which means all those thousands of lawyer jokes definitely have a kernel of truth in them. Like, how many lawyers does it take to change a light bulb? Answer, you won't find a lawyer who can change a light bulb. Now, if you're looking for a lawyer to screw a light bulb. So obviously, there is something wrong when we keep putting up lawyers to lead our nation. Let's start looking at other occupations. How about a shoe salesman in the women's department? There's someone who intimately knows something about human nature. The ongoing struggle to fit a size 8.5 shoe into a size 7 stiletto. There's a person of incredible perseverance. Or what about psychiatrists for president? They deal with all kinds of neuroses. Oh, wait a minute. I just remembered the joke about a young woman goes to a psychiatrist. When she walks into his office, he says, "Take off your clothes and get on the couch." A little confused, she did as asked. They immediately had sex. When finished, the psychiatrist says, "Well, my problem is solved. Now what's yours?" You know, come to think of it, there's only one person should be president. Oprah. She may turn out to be a great president, maybe not. But at least we'll know what books to read. Talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Zen Master Genpo Roshi. He's the author of the book Big Mind, Big Heart, Finding Your Way, and he will be at the Upaya Zen Center here in Santa Fe on the 10th and 11th of August. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello, it's great to have you on the air.
Well, thank you.
You are a Zen master who's developed a method of practice that we're going to talk about, and it all started with a literal peak experience. You were on a mountaintop in 1971. What happened?
Well, I was sitting there. This was February 71, and I went out there really to just kind of get some space, focus on my life. I was having difficulty in a relationship. And while I was sitting out there alone on this mountaintop, I had this experience, which was like turning about 180 degrees from where I was going and what I was pursuing in my life, which was pretty conventional stuff, you know, more security, money, position, jobs, etc., to see having an inner awakening. And seeing that what was most important was knowing who I am and helping other people, assisting others in waking up. It was a waking up experience.
And this just happened spontaneously.
Yes, it did. I was just sitting out there contemplating the question, how could I mess up my life so much at such an early age of 26 and feel so locked into a relationship? So I was really questioning.
So what happened next?
Well, actually, when I came down off the mountain, so to speak, and that evening met up with my two friends who were there, I started to express what happened, because what happened was I became one with the universe, one with the cosmos, and I felt myself completely disappear, and it was such an unbelievably unique experience. It was like taking my head out of pea soup for the first time, and everything made sense, and I felt completely liberated. I was expressing this, and my friend, who was a PhD in psychology at the University of Santa Barbara, said, "Oh, I think you had a Zen experience. You sound and talk like a Zen master." And I guess this planted a seed in me, because I then began to read everything I could on spiritual experiences, mystical experiences, and eventually found my way to Zen books. And they seemed to correspond to the experience I had. And then I found a Zen teacher, a master.
And eventually you became a Zen master, and you developed this practice called Big Mind and Big Heart. What is the nature of these practices?
Well, what Big Mind and Big Heart is I, after exploring, I discovered this in 1999, in June of 99. So if we do the math, it's about 28 years later. But all that time, I was searching and looking as I was going through my own study of Zen and going through the koan study, and I became a Zen teacher in 1980 and a Zen master in 1996. In 1999, I discovered a way to access the Zen experience for anyone who was open to doing it. And that's what I've been doing now for the past 8 years, is taking this around the world and finding literally thousands, if not even hundreds of thousands of people now, finding that they can have a Zen experience, a Zen awakening we call Kensho, or a Satori experience, in a relatively short amount of time, like within an hour. I mean, I've done it even faster. But, you know, usually in a workshop, I build up to it, and by the second hour or third hour, for sure, they're having the same equivalent kind of experience that I had back in February of 71, and that Zen people who sit in monasteries and Zen centers will have over a period of time.
So this is sort of instant, I don't want to trivialize it, but it's sort of instant enlightenment. I mean, does this shortcut the need for years of sitting on a cushion?
Well, yeah, let me clarify something. Zen has always been instant. Zen is known as the sudden school of awakening, and it has been known that way for 2,500 years. So there's nothing derogatory about saying instant enlightenment. That's what Zen is. Compared to other Buddhist practices, Zen is an immediate experience of our true nature. Now, what I found was, rather than fighting it by trying to experience and coming from a place where we're seeking, I've just discovered a way to help people make an immediate shift to non-seeking, and therefore have an opening very spontaneously. So there's nothing about this that is new in the sense of the immediacy or the suddenness. What's new is how anybody can have this experience as soon as we begin to work together, rather than taking years and years for a sudden awakening.
There's a number of paradoxes in spiritual practice that I've come to be aware of, and one of them is this question of whether you're seeking or non-seeking. The big mind is what you call the non-seeking mind, and yet on some level you have to be seeking in order to even show up in the first place. Otherwise, you'd be sitting home watching South Park and eating chocolate.
Exactly, and that's a beautiful analogy and question that you brought up that I want to use an analogy for. Excuse me, and that is, if we and the listener can visualize a triangle. And you have two points on the base of the triangle. It's called 1 and 2. On one point of the base of the triangle is our seeking mind. That's the mind of everydayness, our everyday mind. We call it in Zen ordinary mind. And we all need this seeking in the world. You know, we go to the marketplace, we need to seek out what we want, we need to make decisions, we need to decide, oh, I want white bread, or I want dark bread, or, you know, whatever. And this mind is absolutely essential in our everyday world. However, what we're not aware of is that on point two of the triangle, we have a mind that's absolutely at peace, that's liberated, and it's free from seeking because it's already there, or we can say already here in the present moment, in this instant.
And that's something we might not be so aware of.
That's exactly right. We're not aware of that mind unless we have peak experiences. If we have a peak experience, we have a momentary experience of everything is absolutely perfect as it is, everything is complete and whole, we are complete and whole, and everything is manifesting exactly in that moment beyond good and bad, beyond the relative. So if we look at those two points of the triangle, we cannot move from point one or A to point two or B. We can't move there because that's still, like you said, in the realm of seeking. So we're trying to reach a non-seeking state of mind by seeking, and it just doesn't work. It's like two railroad tracks that run parallel. Off in the distance, it may look like they come together and they meet, but no matter how long we stay on that one track and how far we travel, we'll never reach it. And most people, when they approach meditation and they don't understand how to meditate, see, for me, I was very lucky because I started with that experience. But most people start seeking. And so they stay on that railroad track, and then they get very frustrated because the longer they pursue it, the harder they work, they still find that the goal is off in the distance. What big mind process does is allows the person to make a leap from one track to the other track. And so instead of trying to get there, you're already there. And that's what I mean by big mind is so instantaneous and so sudden, because we just shift from one state of mind to another without trying to move there. So when I ask to speak to that state of mind, like, allow me to speak now to the non-seeking mind, and the person confirms that. They say, yes, you are now speaking to the non-seeking mind. They're there. They're already there.
What's on the third point of the triangle?
Well, the third point is actually, and this is all a relatively new concept that I'm teaching in the last year, because the third point I call the apex, and that is, if we say that the first point is the ordinary mind, and we say that the second point is the way, the mind of the way, where everything is just absolutely perfect as is, it's the unborn Buddha mind, it's the big mind, then when we move to the apex, we include those two points, the point one and point two, and we transcend them. So we move beyond these two, but we include them. So we're not attached to the seeking mind. We're neither attached to the non-seeking mind. And we're coming from a place where these two are not mutually exclusive. In other words, we embrace seeking and non-seeking, and the freedom to move between these two at any given moment. So we're in the market, we make decisions, we're able to distinguish between dark bread and white bread. However, when we're not doing anything, our mind can be at perfect stillness and rest, like when we're meditating. There's a lot of people, when they start to meditate, they sit down in this everyday mind, and they don't see that they're unable, as hard as they try, to get to the non-seeking place. But simply by sitting down, taking the posture, the proper posture, and saying, all right, let me speak now to the non-seeking mind, they're there. At the apex, I call that the ordinary mind is the way, which is a very Zen term. We could also call it the true self or the unique self. There are many, many words that we can use for that apex.
We're talking to Zen Master Genpo Roshi, who will be in Santa Fe at the Upaya Zen Center on August 10th and 11th. I think it's interesting that in your Big Mind practice, you're really combining techniques of Eastern practice and Western psychology. Talk more about the Western part of it.
Well, I would not have discovered this, frankly, had I not been involved in a technique called voice dialogue that was discovered by Hal and Sidra Stone in the 70s. Hal was a Jungian analyst. Sidra was also a therapist. And in 1983-84, I began to study with them, along with several other now Zen masters. And twice a week, we would go and do a couple hours of voice dialogue. And I had been doing various psychotherapies, particularly Gestalt, even since the 60s. And what I always felt was that East and West were going to meet, and the meeting place, unlike in China, it was Taoism and Buddhism. Here, it was going to be Western psychotherapy, Western spirituality and philosophy, and Zen Buddhism or Buddhism in general. And what the Western psychology brought was, of course, Jungian's shadow work, or as Hal and Sidra called it, disowned voices. And so what they knew was that certain aspects of ourself, we had what we call voices that we could speak from, but we didn't identify. Like when I'm angry, I'm speaking from the voice of anger. When I'm frightened, I'm speaking from the voice of fear. And by giving that voice, we could reintegrate these voices back into our whole system and be more whole and complete. What I saw was, of course, in Zen Buddhism, we're coming from a place where we're already whole and complete. In other words, we don't need to seek completeness, we're already there. But what I felt intuitively since 1972 was that East and West coming together would make a more complete whole, whereas Eastern religion and Western psychotherapy were both two parts, or one part of a whole. In other words, each was incomplete on its own. But by merging East and West, we really find a more complete way to life, to living our life more more free.
The work is done, the Big Mind practice is done with a facilitator, and a large part of your book is written in the form of a dialogue between the facilitator and the different parts of the mind, big heart, fear, anger, and so on. These many different. you make an analogy to it's as if you were a big company that had lots of people working there, and you don't even know who all the people are, and it's part of your job to get to know them. But the work is done with a facilitator who actually talks to these people. Do you need a facilitator? To do it? And how do you do it with? How do you do it without?
Well, you don't need a facilitator. In fact, in my book, I teach people how to be their own facilitator. There's a CD that that accompanies the book, and we put that in very purposely.
I listened to the whole thing last night.
Yes, and what you find is it teaches you how to read the book, because this book is written very differently than I think any other book that's ever come out, because people are actually telling me by reading the book they have an opening, or what we can call an enlightened experience, just from reading the book. But it teaches them how to read the book. Of course, the first part of the book is not necessary, but once we get into the voices, it's important for people to know how to work with the voices. And then through the book, I teach them how to do this on their own cushion or chair when they're meditating, and also with one another, so like in a couple situation, or two friends get together, you can learn to facilitate one another, or, as I said, your own self, and actually meditate better right from the beginning.
We're talking to Zen Master Genpo Roshi. So I can imagine that if you did this practice, Big Mind, Big Heart, you got to know all these parts of yourself, it would be very insightful and perhaps profoundly transformative. But then once you've done that, once you've gotten the insight, what do you do next? How do you practice on a daily basis?
Well, that's where daily practice or daily meditation and being aware, mindful of where you're coming from. So historically, mindfulness practice has always been a very strong element of Buddhism. I think that the way that I teach it now is taking it to a new level. And that is, rather than just being mindful of walking, 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 or eating, 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 in our daily lives, the lives that we all live, it's not necessarily that we have the time to just be mindful of walking and eating. Most of us are in a hurry. Most of us have a busy life. We need to be mindful 24/7. And what we can be mindful of is where we are coming from. So in other words, if I'm just been cut off in traffic and I'm upset and anger comes up, then I just notice. I'm just aware, okay, this is the voice of anger. Now, at some point, we transcend that. We don't need to keep doing that practice. It becomes very natural and very spontaneous. But in the beginning, it's a way of practicing mindfulness. Oh, yes, this is the voice of anger. And the voice of anger is here to be angry. So I'm angry. And the moment we identify that, we give ourselves some space from that emotion, the emotion drops much quicker that way. And in Zen tradition, that's always been the thing that we're taught to do, is to become one with the emotion, and then it drops. It's like a good bonfire that just burns itself out. So instead of it lingering on and on and on, you know, the anger and then becoming rage, what happens is we just identify, oh, I am the voice of anger, and then the anger goes.
How has this work really changed you, if I may ask, the way you live, what you do in the world, how you react to people? And I ask this because in my life, such as it is, I've really never met anybody who really changed that much, no matter how much spiritual practice they did, especially their bad personality traits, I include myself, stay bad, and your good ones stay good. Do you feel that you have changed? Do you see others who have truly, genuinely changed?
Well, you know, since I discovered this method in June of 99, not only do I feel I've had a really transformative experience after almost 30 years of Zen training, but I've watched our entire community and worldwide Sangha transform. We are much happier. We are much nicer. The Sangha is much more open and loving and appreciative of one another. There's much less competitiveness, much less trying to one-up the other person. Using the big mind and big heart technique or process has allowed people, I think, in our Zen communities to really manifest what in Zen has always been the point, which is wisdom and compassion and love in the world. Whereas I was teaching traditional practice actually since 1973 and holding private interviews since 78 and being a Zen teacher since 1980, and all those years, I found just what you're saying, that people did not really change. This practice has transformed people more than I can even express, and that's why I am so turned on by it, because after all those years of teaching and finding not making the impact, just what you're saying, the transformative change in character of people, this has really done that, and that's inspired me, and that's why I did the book. Ken Wilber was urging me to do this book, and I resisted and resisted and resisted because I didn't know how could I write a book that was going to have the same impact as, say, a DVD. You know, we have several DVDs out, and that I found works. People, you know, could really make that shift in consciousness. I couldn't imagine how could I do it in a book. And finally, I was on holiday in Hawaii with my two kids. They're not young anymore. One's 24, the other one's going to be 21. Oh, it's 21 today, the 31st of July. I was there last year, last June, and I wrote the whole book in 10 days, and I did it on my BlackBerry because I was really motivated. Once I saw how to write the book, it just flowed out, and that's why I came out with the book.
I have a question for you, and this speaks to a sort of a personal obsession of mine, but when I was reading the Big Mind and what Big Mind is like, and it's really transcendent and it's impersonal and it's universal and people have access to that, do you feel that if you, for example, were in a situation of torture, in a situation of the kind of interrogation that happens in Abu Ghraib,
like having your tooth drilled without Novocaine?
No, worse than that.
Worse than that, okay.
Yeah, this kind of psychological torture that people are right. subjected to in secret prisons and so on. Can, under that extreme circumstance, can you still go into Big Mind? I mean, you probably don't know because it hasn't happened to you, but I wondered what you thought about it.
Well, that's why I brought up, I haven't used Novocaine since 1971, and I've had everything from root canals to crowns and so forth. And yes, the answer is yes, you can be in that state. I don't want to use the word go into, because that state is always available to us, and it's always present. So yeah, you can access that state, or you can be that state under any condition, even what you're talking about. And if we, again, we go back to the triangle, and we look at that triangle, and we put a human body, your body, within that triangle. Let's say you're sitting there, and you're the triangle. Well, every aspect of that triangle is always present, not just the dualistic or the seeking mind. The non-seeking, non-dual mind is always present, and the apex is always present. So you can be there going through whatever you're going through in your life, including that kind of torture. That doesn't mean you don't feel the pain. You absolutely have pain, but somehow you're able to deal with whatever is coming up more presently and more completely.
Including compassion for those who are hurting you?
You know, yes, you can, because what you're seeing and what comes up actually is more pity and like you said, compassion for these people who may be torturing you, because you see both how they are an extension of you at the same time, not you. And so from the not you, of course, there may be anger, all these emotions, but you're not blocking them. You're not denying these emotions. You're one with the emotion. So if anger comes up, you're angry. It doesn't last. And as you're in that situation, you're going to handle it better. Whatever experience you have, even if it is anger or it is rage, we're not denying any emotion. We're not doing some kind of gymnastics where we don't experience our experience. We experience it completely and fully. It just goes quicker because there's no barriers there and there's nothing that we're clinging to.
Zen Master Genpo Roshi, the time has come. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and we look forward to seeing you at the Upaya Zen Center on August 10th and 11th.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate this very much.
We've been speaking with Zen Master Genpo Roshi, and his book is called Big Mind, Big Heart, Finding Your Way. And it's a book that comes with a CD, and it's published by Big Mind Publishing. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. Oh, and by the way, if you want more information, you can call the Upaya Zen Center or go to upaya.org. That's U-P-A-Y-A. The Santa Fe Radio Cafe broadcasts live from the Santa Fe Baking Company Monday through Friday from 8:05 until 9 o'clock. We are on the web streaming at ksfr.org. You can also go to my website, which is radiocafe@ksfr.org. My website is santafe.radiocafe.org. The email is... ladies and gentlemen, my big mind has been completely erased by this interview. What is my email address? radiocafe@ksfr.org. I better stop while we're ahead here. We want to thank Dotfoil Computer Services for their help. And... you stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown, broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. My name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow.